I'm Bill Teeple. I'm here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and we're the hosts of Icon Art Radio. A while back, we're going to talk about the semi-annual course that I have created for Icon on the history of art. And this got started because Bill Witherspoon asked me to do a course for his staff at Sky Factory. Sky Factory is very interesting. In fact, Sky Factory would be a good topic for one of our shows, and we should get Bill Witherspoon over here. I think I may have even mentioned it to him. Mm-hmm. We have to do that, because Sky Factory is his most recent business enterprise, and he has, in creating this company, wanted to create a company that was approached from the angle of creating a business, business as a work of art. Can a business be approached as you might approach making a painting, where it's constantly self-regulating to get to be sort of a beautiful expression that works beautifully and works the best for everyone involved, and has a product that is successful and beautiful, and the whole thing is financially successful. It suits my desire to have art and life become integrated, and it's inspiring that there's somebody that's actually from the nuts and bolts business side of things attempting that integration. I for some time left off the making of commodities for the art market, because I felt that we could integrate art and life in a deeper way. But I hadn't gone so far as to try to create a business, a manufacturing business with a product that's sold nationally from that point of view. So my hat goes off to Bill and his attempt in this area. Well, one of the things that he has done is to bring in teachers to expand the knowledge base of his staff there, everyone that works there. So he had someone come in and teach them about writing. He had someone come in and teach them about business, someone teach them about financial management, and he had me come in and talk about art history. I never would have probably gotten around to doing something like this, but because between just teaching studio art, making art myself, and curating art for Icon, and not to mention all the organizational things involved with running an arts organization like Icon, the idea of also now approaching art history seemed like it was never something that I would get my attention on. But Bill asked me to do this, and he sort of like twisted my arm a little bit, because I was saying, no, I just don't think I can do this, but he really wanted me to do it. And so I said, okay, I'll give it a try. So what I sort of did was put together, in between all my other activities, something that I looked at as a rough draft, something that isn't a final end product, but was putting my attention there as an artist and a curator, not as an art historian. I don't want to teach people to memorize lists of paintings with dates and titles and have to try to memorize the painting with all that information. And what I want to do is to share my enthusiasm. What I have done with this is to share my enthusiasm and love of beauty with others by showing them examples. And that's my art history. This was a very successful event with his company. And I decided to offer it twice a year, in the spring and in the fall, through the Teeple Creative Arts Institute as a course. So now I do a 10-lesson course on my response to the expressions of human intelligence over the centuries. And it includes over 1,500 slides, 1,500 images that I've put together. And I'm having a blast doing this. So I thought we could talk a little bit about what I'm doing with that, and you could ask some questions, and we could bring up some of the points. It's not quite as luscious and juicy without the slides, because I think the slides drive the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Basically, I flash something on the screen, and I'm so enthusiastic about it, sometimes I can't help but go, wow, when I see that picture, because I'm just so moved by beauty.
Yeah, and everybody, and that's contagious, because when you were giving your little introduction to your course, and you were showing, running through the slides quickly to give people a taste of it, that was what we were enjoying the most, was that you, every time you'd put a new slide, you'd go, ooh, ooh, get all excited about it.
And if I can do anything with the course, it's to pass on my enthusiasm mm-hmm. for beauty. And so I call this course The Quest for Beauty. It's my quest for beauty, it's mankind's quest for beauty, and I would like, and the audience and the people that are taking the course, I want to get them on the quest of beauty and enliven that quest for them. Because it's a never-ending quest for more and more mm-hmm. lusciousness of visual experience.
Yeah, and people who are not avid museum goers or who have not really studied art history extensively, there are many gaps in their knowledge. You know, everybody knows what the Mona Lisa looks like or you know, Van Gogh's sunflowers or something like that. But there are many artists who, like Paul Klee or Kandinsky or people like that, that aren't as commonly known to the wide mass of people in the world. And when you turn people on to some of those artists' work, they can have these amazing aha experiences, like, oh my goodness, you can do that in art. Oh, you can do that. And they're just amazed at all of the experimentation that these artists have done that have then been tried by other people and have evolved in different ways. So I think you're playing a really great role in opening people's eyes to all of the many expressions of art that have come out.
Well, particularly in Fairfield, the most of the general audience in Fairfield hasn't had a lot of experience with art history. Mm-hmm. The artists, the trained artists that have gone to school, of course, have. But there's even a lot of just sort of self-trained artists in Fairfield that don't have the background. And so to even expose them to some of the different doorways and alleyways that visual intelligence has gone down is going to advance them and grow them as artists. Mm-hmm. Even people who have general art history, I think it's good for me to open up my angle, my personal appreciation of certain things throughout the art history, and just to get my enthusiasm. But in general, the audience has not even been exposed, so I get so much fulfillment out of showing someone something they've never seen before that is really filled with visual beauty.
So where do you start? Do you go all the way back to the cave paintings?
I want to take people on a journey, and what I do is I take people on a journey of how human intelligence has expressed itself throughout the entire of art history. And the interesting thing is that it cycles, and that you'll see how intelligence flows in a pendulum swing from the earliest times. And in fact, what I'll talk to people about is if you just make a mark on a piece of paper, you're enlivening a duality of dark and light. You're creating space, and you're creating a work of art, and you're creating something. But you move that line, and you're creating something in space. And that line could be a straight line, or it could be a curved line. I mean, right in the beginning, you get these choices of you can go this way, or you can go that way. And what we observe in art history, I mean, if we observe the way that intelligence flows and expresses itself, you can just think of this in terms of the way all of culture flows and how we have two sides of things. We have the Democrats and the Republicans, we have the conservatives and the liberals, and we have people that are just will just wildly go off without any planning. We have people that have to plan everything before they do it. Well, we see these qualities of intelligence express themselves in art history. And it's sort of like a visual record. And then we have these same records in the expressions through poetry and literature and dance and these other kinds of artistic expression, but I'm dealing specifically with visual expression. There's the people that have to do things very planned, and before they can start, they have to plan it carefully, and it's very tight and very stable and full of structure. Then we have the people that just like launch and have to, they just launch. Well, in art history, we call these the classics, the classical artists and the romantic artists. Mm-hmm. But in the very beginning impulses of artistic expression, we see these even with the person that wants the straight lines and the person that likes the curvy lines, and it goes that way. So it's interesting to, I'm just using this as an example of as we watch intelligence flow through time, we see these pendulum swings this way and that way, and what we can feel that inside of man expressing himself outwardly, and we just see the flow of intelligence this way and that, and flowing and appreciating over here, and then flowing this way and appreciating over here, and talking about it. And that's what the artists do. And it's so it's exciting to watch. What I start with is natural expression. In fact, I'll name the different stages that I go through with this class. Natural expression, ancient civilization. And now, here's the thing. I was trained in European art, and I'm a Western European artist. So my most intimate connection with intelligence flowing through time is more rooted in European art and American art. So that's the foundation of this course I've created, although I will pick up and bring in what's been going on globally. So natural expression, ancient civilization, Europe, 600 BC to 1750, neoclassicism, romanticism in the 19th century, this is at 1750 on to towards the 20th century. But then I go and I pick up Asia, China, Japan, and I show what was going on in the rest of the globe. And one of the reasons that I go there is that Japan had a huge, the Orient, and particularly Japan, had a huge influence on European artists about mid-1800s. So after a little bit of excursion into the Orient, then we come back and we talk about what I call the turning point. And this is where we move into the modernist period, really. We're talking about around 1850, 1860, with Impressionism and Post-Impressionism. And then I talk about industrialization and that impact and the reaction of the artistic intelligence to what was happening in the world with industrialization. And then I take the course into modernism up to 1950. And then I finished off with architecture because that's the way I set the whole thing up with Sky Factory, and I still continue to do that. Because they were so interested in interior design and architecture and space with what they're doing over there. So I think that's a nice way to end it. The whole thing flows differently depending on the course, because sometimes we'll be talking about one issue in a class and it'll go a little bit long, so I'll carry the slides over. So each class is different. Each group of people changes the dialogue and how we look at things and how I talk about things. The reason I go to 1950 is that the jury is pretty much in on the finest pieces of art that have come down the pipe to that point, and so I can really point at those pieces that contain that element that I call beauty. And after that, whenever we talk about a contemporary art scene, such as the postmodern world that we're in today, it's very difficult to know exactly what's happening. When you're in the middle of it, it's like you can't see the forest for the trees because it's just too dense. And time sorts things out, and we kind of can see a little bit from a distance, and we can see it with some objectivity. But people get biased by contemporary notions, their own contemporary notions, and it sort of fogs your ability to see, cut through to what's really happening until you get outside of it, and I think we all have that experience. So I take this course just that far, because it's also about objects of visual beauty. I don't like question the, I don't go beyond the idea of objects of visual beauty or objects that redefine the way we see ourselves. And once we get into the 1960s, we have a paradigm shift where art leaves the realm of the object, and it almost, and this is the realm of conceptual art, where we begin to question the very boundaries of what art itself is. And I don't get into that in this course. I'm planning actually to put together a course that deals with contemporary, but it's such a difficult thing to approach that I would want to do justice to it, and so I'm going to let that develop as I'm able to develop it, because I have to bring up all of the different angles on contemporary art.
Maybe instead of even thinking of it as contemporary art, just looking at art without boundaries or art without the kind of history that makes it art.
And in fact, the art, some of the critics of today have called 1960 the point at which the era of art ended. Mm-hmm. That it's the end. You know, we often think of the early Renaissance as the time when we had the era of art beginning. Yeah. It's not that art or beautiful objects or the making of objects or was not done prior to that, but we consciously became artists in that period, and that they talk about that period extending from say the 1300s to 1960, because that's at the point where the whole thing began to be questioned, and it's like this, it's sort of a linear progress towards an end that was taking place with all of art history. Then we get to a place where that is done. I think this is actually what's happened with culture too. Mm-hmm. We've got to a place where the traditional boundaries of what we perceive art as has now come to a close, and artists are still continuing, people are still calling themselves artists, and people are still continuing to be creative, but it's like a whole new ball game because all the different art forms have gotten melted together. It's not so distinctly areas of sculpture, architecture, painting.
Well, it's not tied to individual, highly specialized skills. It's more tied to a more general, amorphous skill of being an artist, where the medium is something that the artist gets to choose. If you're trained as a Renaissance painter, you don't have much choice about medium. You're going to be oil painting on canvas and maybe doing frescoes on plaster, but that's pretty much it. Whereas now you might be working in something where the medium isn't even related to art and in any traditional sense, but what you're doing with it is expressing something in a domain that traditionally didn't exist. I mean, on a smaller scale, it's what's happening with me composing, because I'm trying to minimize the use of melody, harmony, and rhythm, which are the heart and soul of what we normally think of as music, but I'm still making a composition. It still, in some cases, even has sonata form. It still actually is a sound experience. And you hear it, you play it on speakers in a room just like you play Beethoven. But the boundaries of what determines whether it's music or not are being, you know, dissolved. They're disappearing. I'm perfectly happy not to call it music. I don't care if you want to call it music or not. My problem is that it would be nice to have something to call it. So I call it sound art. That's kind of what I've fallen back onto now. I've tried a whole lot of other things, and it seems like it's just sound art. But I was talking with Ed Sarath last week. He's a professor of jazz improv at the University of Michigan. And he went to MUM some years ago, and he's been back to help a group of us who are trying to design a curriculum for a new music school, a school of music at MUM. And he has some fascinating ideas, and he approaches the whole learning of the traditional segments of formal music study, including, you know, harmony and composition and keyboard skills and reading and notation and all of that. But he approaches all of it from the perspective of improvisation. And so you improvise, which means you compose music in the moment, and you, by doing so, you create needs for these other skills. And so it's like a painter, a modern painter who's trying to paint something that has nothing to do with Renaissance art, but at some point he gets to a position where he needs to know how to use oils on canvas because it suits whatever the heck he's doing at the moment. And 2 years from now, he may not be working on canvas anymore. There's something consistent about what he's doing as an artist, but it's not the medium. So maybe that's one of the key things that characterizes this sort of...
Yeah, it's a very exciting time because of the unknown and the reforming and reshaping of the whole game. Yeah. And
Go ahead.
Well, I would just say one thing, and then you can go... It's difficult to commodify it. And so we have this entire art industry whose whole reason to exist, the museums and the galleries and the art magazines and the writers and all of this, that is a kind of industry, and not to mention the collectors and all the money and power involved with this. These people don't quite know how to
monetize.
Control it, because we're talking about art forms that are sometimes just ideas that are just and that are like momentary performances that can't be or in musical things that maybe can be captured somewhat in a recorded device or maybe witness, I mean, the kind of thing you're talking about, or maybe it's just what the artist does in his studio. Bruce Nauman said art is what the artist does in his studio. Mm-hmm. And that left it up to the artist to say whether it's art or not. And then we have to, which opens up an interesting thing. I don't want to go off on that because you had a point to say, so go ahead and say it.
Well,
because we'll go off on that eventually.
Because this whole thing, it's a spiraling around again, like we've been talking, we talked about in the last show, where before, in the cave painting days and in many cultures of the world even today, creative activities and the producing of beautiful objects isn't separate from life. It isn't put in a separate category called fine art. It's just, you know, the people weave their clothes in a beautiful way because those are the garments that they wear in that culture or whatever. They paint their bodies in these beautiful designs because that's part of their culture. And it seems like this contemporary era of art, in a way, has circled back to that.
It is.
Where life and art are not divided up into categories. The fragmentation of the categories you said, like painting and sculpture, are dispelled with. But not only that, the division of life itself and being an artist isn't, you know, there's not a boundary even there. And so there's something quite healthy, it seems like.
It seems like a very healthy thing. And we're going to go through some birthing pains here as we find our way back. Because what I do bring out in this first course that I call Natural Expression is that expression is natural, that it can't be suppressed, that we just have to do it. And it's natural for the soul to seek out beauty, to seek out that qualities of fine design are natural to the soul in performance of action. And so that's where, but they don't think of themselves as artists. They're not artists, they're making a basket. Mm-hmm. And it can be a very functional basket, or it could be a basket that's got some design on it. And so they have, intelligence is making that choice, and they're not thinking that I'm an artist, they're thinking I'm making a basket. And it's that embedded, that the art is that embedded in everyday life. Well, now we're coming around to the two knots, but what happens over the history of art history, what we see is this separation of the two apart, especially when we get into this era of art. There are artists and there's non-artists. I mean, and what is even an artist? Is it someone who arts? Is that what an artist is? I mean, we don't even ask the question anymore, but in asking the questions, which we started to do in the 60s, we find that it's terribly interesting territory to explore. What can it be to continue being creators and not have to confine it at all, but to be a natural creator, someone who is naturally expressing himself? Then the interesting thing is that the act has to stand on its own for its intrinsic value. Now, this is my point that I make a lot. I would like to have the whole thing come to the point that that people can't any longer justify anything they do just because they call themselves artists. I want their acts to be justified on the basis of whether they actually have intrinsic value to the totality.
Yeah, because it takes away the elitism element, which the status quo of the art world in many points in art history fought desperately to hold on to, because that was their power base. You know, we are the authorities on what art is. And that power base, you know, the foundation of that is being dismantled now. And everyone can be an artist.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.